Hello and welcome to the DSR Daily. It's one of your co-hosts, David Rothkopf, joined today by just one other co-host, Riley Fessler. How you doing, Riley?
Pretty good.
Chris is out of pocket for the day. We'll try to manage our way through the stories. Riley's got a list pulled together, and I'll do what I do in terms of trying to provide some kind of commentary. Riley, why don't you start in Haiti?
Yeah, so the big news out of Haiti is that the Prime Minister Ariel Henry has announced his resignation amidst the escalating violence and pressure. And, you know, Chris and I covered this yesterday. We knew that a lot of forces were kind of pressuring him to do this. So it is not really a big surprise that he has announced that he will resign. He is currently stranded in Puerto Rico, and in his video address called for calm and promised his government's resignation following the installation of a transition council. So his tenure has been kind of, you know, increasingly under scrutiny in recent years. But, you know, I'm curious what form this transition council is going to take.
Yeah. And also, you know, is this transition council going to deal with the gang problem in Haiti? Is it going to get the gangs to stop attacking people? Is that endemic to other issues in Haiti? Bad policing, a lot of poverty, social tension. Those things have been in a part of Haitian life for decades. Periodically, this is exactly what happens. Governments come, they go. The sort of wealthier people in Haiti manage their way around this on a regular basis, and everybody else continues to suffer. It is a grim and sad situation. One hopes a new government will have some more success with it, but the reality is that to expect that would be to ignore the past several decades and indeed the past couple of hundred years of Haitian history. This is a country that deserves better. And ultimately, I think it's going to take a greater commitment from the international community to help Haiti address some of its core problems. What's next?
So, pretty sweeping attack by Ukraine on Russia ignited two fires at major oil facilities. And at the same time, the Freedom of Russia Legion, Russian Volunteer Corps, and the Siberian Battalion, which are groups of Russian citizens fighting with Ukrainian forces, also launched attacks into Russia, which was backed up by video evidence but not verified independently. At the same time, Russia claimed to have repelled them, causing heavy losses, which was also not independently confirmed. So, you know, we don't have a lot of information on those armed groups' attacks, but we do know that the Ukrainian drones were pretty successful igniting these two fires. And it just shows that, you know, the fight goes on. Ukraine is able to kind of launch a counterattack here. Obviously, they still need more aid, but it's good to see that, you know, there's still fight in Ukraine. Not all is lost yet.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, the attack on the oil facilities was hundreds of miles to the east of Moscow, in Nizhny Novgorod. So it shows the reach of Ukrainian supporters and Ukrainian intelligence operatives and others working within Russia is pretty great. If Ukraine is unable to fight using traditional means in Ukraine because it's running out of weapons, I think we can expect to see more of asymmetric conflict and more of that in Russia, simply because that's something that enables Ukraine to put up resistance, strike the Russians in a way that has a significant political value within Russia, and do so at a comparatively low cost. That said, it's the middle of March. The United States still has not stepped up. The Republican line seems to be hardening on Ukraine. And Bill Burns, the CIA director, testifying this week, said, if we don't provide more aid immediately, then we are going to see more setbacks within Ukraine. And he raised the possibility of very significant reversals by later in the year. That would be a disaster on many fronts. We've already got Russia not only pursuing this war and doubling down, but, you know, there are signs of their desire to, you know, continue some kind of expansion into Europe in the Moldovan province of Transnistria with the Russians, which the Russians claim. The Russians have said they're going to set up voting sites. So Russian-speaking residents of Transnistria can vote in the Russian elections, which are at the end of this week, early next week. And this, of course, has the Moldovans worried that they are essentially annexing or seeking to annex this part of Moldova. So not only is the U.S. lack of support for Ukraine going to produce the kind of damage that Bill Burns is talking about, but it makes the rest of the Europe at much greater risk. And that's not theoretical. It's happening in real time, right in front of our eyes. Riley?
So an aid ship carrying 200 tons of food, was organized by the World Central Kitchen, has set sail from Cyprus heading to Gaza as part of a pilot program to open a sea corridor in an effort to get aid into Gaza. The new sea route is supported by the EU, US, UAE, and others, and of course aims to kind of alleviate the horrific conditions in Gaza right now by delivering food directly. This is at the same time that President Biden has announced plans to open up a kind of port to also facilitate the delivery of aid. And again, it just highlights how unprecedented this is. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has said this is the first time that a ship has been permitted to directly deliver aid to Gaza since 2005. So it shows that, you know, this crisis does not have really any precedence in recent memory. So hopefully this is a success. The World Central Kitchen has 65 kitchens in the region that they're planning to distribute this food at. So hopefully it can alleviate some of the pressures, but of course it's not enough. There needs to be more, and hopefully more is coming.
Yeah, well, I mean, the, you know, the United States is trying to build a port, help build a temporary port there, but that's going to take weeks and weeks. So that's not going to actually prove to be an early solution. The Israelis have said they would open up another corridor into the north of Gaza, but that's not going to be a long-term solution. We have now reports this week of deaths from famine. And of course, tensions are high because this is the holy month of Ramadan. In a related story, President Biden said over the weekend that if Israel went into Rafah in southern Gaza, it would be violating a red line. He immediately tried to walk this back a little bit. But he was clear that but in walking it back, he meant the U.S. would continue to provide defensive weapons to Israel. But there might be other weapon systems that we would cease to provide. And indeed, a story in Politico late yesterday from four different sources underscored that this is indeed the case. The U.S. Sees Rafah as a red line. The response, of course, of the Israelis was from Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he said there's no red line. He said we're going to go into Rafah. And it illustrates that the U.S.-Israel relationship right now is about as bad as it's ever been. It is broken down. It is toxic. It is dysfunctional. And frankly, as long as Netanyahu is the prime minister of Israel, it's not going to get much better. But the U.S. has changed its policy fairly dramatically. And many people are frustrated that the United States didn't do more sooner, didn't use conditionality as a lever sooner. That's certainly, I think, a fair criticism, but we are at a point where U.S. policy is changing in substantial ways. airdrops are happening. We're building this port. We are trying to help the people of Gaza. We're essentially on both sides in the war. But we are also now finally saying, no, weapon systems will stop if you do this thing that we don't think you should do. So we'll see if that has an effect. But this crisis is not any closer to being resolved today than it has been since October the 7th. Riley?
If you're tired of hearing ads, you can support the show by becoming a member. This week, listeners of the DSR Network shows can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and early access to select podcasts. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSRNetwork, one word, to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSRNetwork. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, March 16th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
So in Kaduna, Nigeria, nearly 300 school students were kidnapped by armed individuals, which has prompted a major search operation by Nigerian soldiers. The army, which is being supported by local police, intelligence agencies, the Air Force, and the Kaduna State Vigilance Service, is searching for the kidnappers. And this is part of a kind of a greater trend. This tactic of abducting school children was really started in the country by Boko Haram, but has since been adopted by just armed groups that are seeking ransom payments. So this is certainly not the first time this has happened, but it just highlights the fact that this is still an issue. I mean, I can't even imagine 300 students being abducted from a single city. I mean, that has to be just incredibly crippling emotionally and, you know, just in every sense of the word. I can't even imagine the anguish that their parents are feeling. So hopeful that this is successful, the search for these students. It certainly seems like all forces have been mobilized to try and find them, but there's no sign of them yet. So a story to keep our eyes on for sure.
Yeah, and of course, as you know, this is not the first time this has happened. Boko Haram does this kind of thing. They've done it before. It led to a big global campaign about bringing back our girls when a bunch of girls were kidnapped. And, again, for reasons that we try to make clear on a daily basis, this is just the kind of horrific attack that would be paralyzing to entire societies if they happened in Europe or the United States or in Asia. All the media would be focused on it, and it will get next to no attention here. But nonetheless, the suffering involved is very real. And once again, you know, this will play itself out. And then it'll happen again, and it'll happen again, and it'll happen again. What do you got next there, Riley?
Well, shifting to a domestic focus, Robert Hur, the special counsel who investigated Biden, will be testifying before Congress today. And I cannot imagine that he is going to have a particularly good time, as he is reviled by both parties right now, by Republicans for not pressing charges against Biden, and then by Democrats for his comments in his report that seemed to go well beyond kind of the scope of the report. A kind of big one that grabbed headlines was his characterization of Biden as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, and kind of allegations that he couldn't remember the date of his son's death. So I'm kind of curious what this hearing is even going to turn up. He's currently actually testifying as a private citizen as he resigned as special counsel. So I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts, David, on what you think this is even going to really result in, if anything.
This is more performative nonsense from the Republicans on the Hill. They just want to create a news story. Hur has resigned from the Department of Justice. So he's no longer sort of doing this with the imprimatur of the Justice Department, which frankly he shouldn't have had in the first place. He is a Trump appointee more than once. He's a demonstrable hack He went far beyond his brief in trying to, you know, taint President Biden. I think his criticisms of President Biden have been proven wrong in front of tens of millions of people, you know, at the State of the Union, at campaign addresses since then, in interviews with people who work with Biden on a daily basis, just a lot of nonsense. But, you know, the Republicans will stop at nothing. The truth is no barrier for them. And it bodes, you know, ill for the campaign to come. They just literally seem to have dropped the gloves, and they're going to fight any way that they can. Lies. You've got Trump attacking E. Jean Carroll yesterday. You've got him attacking the court system again yesterday. You've got them, you know, the Trump family took over the RNC, and reports late yesterday had them firing 60 people in the RNC, which can't be good for anybody else in the Republican Party, but it's designed to put the whole apparatus, which mainly the fundraising apparatus, under the control of the Trump family so that they can direct as many of those funds as possible to Trump legal defenses and other Trump needs. This is bad, bad, bad for down ballot Republicans. Couldn't happen to a bunch of nicer men and women, as we have seen recently. Final example of the big lie is, of course, Katie Britt during her response to the State of the Union, coming up with a story about human trafficking and sexual abuse under Biden that was not under Biden, that was not involving the cartels, as she said, that was not a private conversation that she had, that was actually something that happened in the George W. Bush administration. It was complete fabrication. And so one of the things we're going to have to do here on a regular basis is look and listen to what's happening and, you know, play the role that all journalists should play of saying, this is the truth. This is not the truth. This may look like a normal congressional hearing, but it's not. It's a game. It's play acting. And that's what's going to happen here today. Got one more?
Yeah, one more. And this comes from a Washington Post investigation where they analyzed FBI data, which revealed a significant increase in school hate crimes targeting LGBTQ plus individuals. And this was an increase across the board, but even higher in states with laws restricting LGBTQ plus student rights and education. Those states in particular saw a more than fourfold increase in such crimes on K-12 campuses. At the same time, crisis hotlines like the Trevor Project and Rainbow Youth Project have experienced a surge in calls from youth facing distress, often citing the anti-LGBT political rhetoric as a contributing factor. And, you know, this is just part of kind of the greater culture war that the conservatives are fighting. But it just shows that, you know, this rhetoric has very real consequences. I mean, a fourfold increase in hate crimes on K-12 campuses is just incredible. It's horrific. And it's targeting groups that are already marginalized and just, you know, placing them under even more of a microscope than they already are. And, you know, nothing good can possibly come from that. I can't, you know, it's disgusting.
Look, if you promote hate, it produces bad acts. It produces expressions of that hate. If you promulgate laws that institutionalize that hate, how do you think kids are going to react who live in that kind of environment? And that's what they want. They want generations to grow up that are as intolerant as they are. It destroys society. It is profoundly corrosive. And it is exactly what the MAGA movement is seeking to do with its entire anti-woke campaign. I should add, by the way, that this war on wokeness is not just a U.S. phenomenon, Putin practices it. Orban practices it. Bolsonaro practiced it. Intolerance is obviously a signature of the Netanyahu administration. Intolerance is a signature of the Modi administration in India. The entire right-wing, authoritarian movement globally attacks scapegoat groups, minority groups, groups that can easily be identified as the other, because it's the oldest technique in the book for creating unity among your base and taking the blame and shifting it to somebody else. It's despicable. It's getting worse in the United States. And we're going to do our best to call it out, not just here, but on all of our podcasts. And we've got plenty for you. Later today, we've got a really interesting interview with CNN's Jim Sciutto in a book on sort of great power politics that he's just come out with. But it's also the book in which he reveals things like the fact that Trump expressed to his advisors admiration for Adolf Hitler. And if you don't see the connection between that story and the story Riley just read you, tune in. It's clear, but we'll make it even clearer. Until then, thanks for joining us. Come back tomorrow. Chris will be back tomorrow. Riley will be back tomorrow, and I'll be back tomorrow. We'll see you all then. Bye-bye.